KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
My testimony is I did not recall the exact details of what was included there.
The Trump administration and Republicans are downplaying the significance of the messages from a leaked Signal chat published by The Atlantic.
For Wednesday, March 26th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Ohio History Connection is home to one of the largest collections of Native American human remains.
It is consulting with tribes to repatriate them.
We are now on this timeline to make sure that our ancestors are treated with respect, but we have no more funding to make sure it's done correctly.
Also, every year, hundreds of thousands of immigrants become U.S. citizens.
That process can be tough if the soon-to-be new American is unable to hear.
She's kind of like the embodiment of the Statue of Liberty. She's been through some very serious things that most people never experience.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump is ordering a 25% tariff on all imported cars. NPR's Scott Horsley reports that's a tenfold increase in the current import levy.
President Trump says the new auto tariff will take effect next week. It's intended to raise revenue for the government while also encouraging more domestic auto production.
I think our automobile business will flourish like it's never flourished before.
Stock in domestic automakers declined in the hours leading up to the announcement. The 25% tariff on imported cars matches what the U.S. already charges on imported trucks. Trump is promising to levy additional import taxes on lumber, pharmaceuticals, and other products. Economists say the moves will lead to higher prices for U.S. consumers and likely retaliation by foreign trading partners against U.S. exports. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration has begun canceling billions of dollars of funding for projects related to the COVID-19 pandemic. NPR's Rob Stein has more.
The Health and Human Services Department says the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is canceling more than $11 billion in funding for a wide range of pandemic-related work, including COVID-19 testing, vaccination, and community health workers. NPR has also learned the National Institutes of Health has terminated a $577 million project to find new drugs to fight the virus that causes COVID, as well as other viruses that have the potential to cause the next pandemic. The administration says the decision was made because the pandemic is over and the terminations will save billions of dollars. Researchers say the COVID virus is still spreading and the moves leave the country more vulnerable to future pandemics. Rob Stein, NPR News.
The heads of NPR and PBS appeared before Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene and members of the House DOGE subcommittee today. Greene calling the public media outlets radical left-wing echo chambers, undeserving of taxpayer dollars. California Democrat Robert Garcia asked PBS head Paula Kerger about two Sesame Street characters.
These two guys actually live together. They're friends. They're supportive of each other. Now, that might be triggering to our chairwoman and someone in this committee, and perhaps that's also why we're here today. Ms. Kerger, an important question. Are Bert and Ernie part of an extreme homosexual agenda?
No.
Thank you, Ms. Kerger, and thank you for being a good sport. Now, I'm obviously using some humor here, but the fact that we're sitting here today talking about defunding public television is actually not funny.
NPR CEO Catherine Marr acknowledged NPR has at times made mistakes but defended its commitment to serving different viewpoints. Greene ended the hearing promising to defund the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Declines in some tech heavyweights like NVIDIA and Tesla helped pull the overall U.S. markets down. The Dow fell 132 points today. You're listening to NPR. Gun safety groups are hailing a U.S. Supreme Court decision on the issue of so-called ghost guns. The 7-2 decision upholds a Biden administration rule that would require continued serial numbers, background checks, and age verification to buy kits to build otherwise untraceable weapons, making them far easier for police to track. Michigan woman whose son was accidentally shot by a friend with one of the guns says she's deeply relieved by the court's decision. Shifting winds and lingering dry weather are fueling a pair of wildfires in the South Carolina mountains. From South Carolina Public Radio, Scott Morgan reports the fires have grown rapidly since yesterday.
Ground crews are battling rugged terrain as they work to contain the fires at Table Rock and Persimmon Ridge. And a shift in winds Tuesday provided another obstacle, says Madeline Stewart of the South Carolina Forestry Commission.
Those high winds and that extreme fire behavior caused the fire to move in the opposite direction from what we were expecting.
From Tuesday to Wednesday, both blazes grew significantly, with the Table Rock fire doubling and the Persimmon Ridge fire tripling in size. Stewart says 20 additional crews have been called in and containment lines have been moved farther away. For NPR News, I'm Scott Morgan in Rock Hill, South Carolina.
A pair of escaped river otters who broke out of a Wisconsin zoo appear to be in no hurry to return and may in fact be enjoying their newfound freedom. Zoo officials say the otters Louie and Ophelia busted out of their enclosure last week during a winter storm. Zookeepers say it appears the pair has not gone far, though, and will return to their zoo perimeter based on tracks. Otters are native to that area and can survive in local ponds and streams without much outside help. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Presidential administrations usually want to keep sensitive military operations closely guarded while the media calls for more details. Today, this was all turned upside down. The Atlantic magazine published a group chat with the defense secretary providing real-time information on U.S. airstrikes in Yemen. The Trump administration and Republicans dismiss this as no big deal. For more, we're joined now by NPR's Greg Myrie. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Juana.
So, Greg, start if you can by just telling us what The Atlantic published about this group chat, which was among the country's highest-ranking national security officials.
Yeah, The Atlantic's editor, Jeffrey Goldberg, said in his initial story Monday that he considered some of the military information shared on the publicly available messaging app Signal to be too sensitive to be published. But President Trump and other top officials downplayed the group chat and insisted it didn't contain any classified information. So The Atlantic published it today. And 2 hours before the operation began on March 15th, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth wrote, quote, "We are a go for mission launch." And then he kept providing updates saying F-18 warplanes and Reaper drones had taken off to carry out attacks. And want to keep in mind the Houthis have shot down U.S. drones, so there are some real risks here. And Hegseth gave these real-time updates for several hours. He knew he was on Signal and not a secure government network, but he, of course, was unaware Goldberg had been inadvertently included in this group.
Right. Okay, so this new Atlantic story, it came out this morning, and that was shortly before the House Intelligence Committee held a hearing where some of these senior officials were present. How did that hearing play out?
The Democrats on the committee said repeatedly this was a major security breakdown, and they simply did not believe Trump administration officials claiming this was not classified information or that they couldn't remember details. Here's one exchange between Jim Hines from Connecticut, the ranking Democrat on the committee, and Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, who was on that Signal chat.
Less than 2 weeks ago, you were on a Signal chat that had all of this information about F-18s and MQ-9 Reapers and targets on strike, and you in that two-week period simply forgot that that was there. That's your testimony?
My testimony is I did not recall the exact details of what was included there.
Greg, are we likely to see a formal investigation into this episode?
Right now, that looks unlikely. FBI Director Kash Patel was also questioned at the hearing. He said he wasn't part of that Signal group chat. He didn't know much about it, and he just didn't give any indication that he would investigate. Now, Democrats still have lots of unanswered questions. Were these officials using their personal phones, which are much easier to hack, or were they on government devices? You know, have security officials been setting up other group chats like this on Signal? So Democrats may keep pushing for answers, even if there's no formal investigation.
Greg, before I let you go, I just want to sort of take a step back here and ask you a sort of basic question, which is this. Why is the U.S. bombing Yemen again?
So when the U.S. attacks began on March 15th, the U.S. officials on signals were congratulating each other and sending emojis. But, Juana, we could be looking at an open-ended, extended military campaign. The Trump administration says it wants to halt the Houthi attacks on commercial shipping in the Red Sea, which the Houthis have been doing for well over a year, and they call it an act of solidarity with the Palestinians. The Trump team says this military campaign will be much more robust than under the Biden administration. But the Houthis have proved very resilient, and it's just not clear whether a U.S. bombing campaign, even a sustained one, could end their attacks or bring about a resumption of normal commercial shipping in the Red Sea.
That is NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, thank you.
Sure thing, Juana.
Every year, hundreds of thousands of immigrants become U.S. citizens. It can be a proud moment, but the process can be challenging, especially if the soon-to-be new American is unable to hear. A woman in Ohio overcame that obstacle. Anna Huntsman of IdeaStream Public Media reports.
All rise.
On this day, it's standing room only at a naturalization ceremony in the federal courthouse in Cleveland.
Will the petitioners please stand?
The immigrants waiting to be sworn in come from 31 different countries. One of them is 66-year-old Florence Basaki. She is deaf and mostly nonverbal. And with no American Sign Language interpreter at this ceremony, she must rely on visual cues and a friend, Catherine Hardinger, who has come with her.
She's kind of like the embodiment of the Statue of Liberty. She's been through some very serious things that most people never experience.
Hardinger works for a nonprofit that helped Basaki in her path to citizenship with transportation and other services. She knows Basaki's story well and says she has overcome many hardships in her life. In addition to being deaf, Basaki faced domestic abuse and lived through the brutal regime of then-Uganda President Idi Amin in the 1970s. She immigrated to the U.S. 12 years ago.
And to overcome that with all of the additional challenges she has, even just to make it to America, is incredible.
Basaki is divorced. She has four adult children and came to America by herself. She rarely speaks and communicates mostly by writing on a sheet of paper. When asked about her life growing up deaf in Uganda, Hardinger reads Basaki's response out loud.
No deaf kids were heard of. They blamed mom that she had a curse because I became deaf. Going to school was a challenge. No sign language. But mom stood firm and accepted me.
Please raise your right hands.
Basaki stands and raises her hand when she notices others around her doing so. Hardinger says Basaki requested an interpreter for the naturalization ceremony from immigration officials, but they told her no one was available. They suggested she reschedule, but Hardinger says that wasn't an option.
With everything going on with immigration, with the Trump administration, and also just the very vocal anti-immigration community, we were really nervous that it was going to be put on hold. We were scared that the opportunity would be taken away from her.
That's not the first time there's been barriers. Basaki requested an interpreter for the interview portion of her citizenship test, but none were available.
There's always staffing issues with accommodations.
That's Peggy Gleason, a senior staff attorney with the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, an organization specializing in immigrant rights and policies.
Local offices have to come up with the resources. It takes time. Maybe they're understaffed.
The U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services declined to comment, saying the agency doesn't talk about specific cases. Instead, it offered instructions for how to request accommodations that can be found on its website. Levi King says he's not surprised by the problems Basaki has faced. He works for a nonprofit that provides communication services for the deaf. He says there aren't enough American Sign Language or ASL interpreters to fulfill all sorts of requests.
Because they're not the same as a speaking interpreter. It works differently. The language is completely different.
So, Gleason says if there is no interpreter for the citizenship test, interviewees are allowed to write down their answers, which Basaki did. At the ceremony, immigration officials arranged for her to receive her certificate first and called out her name.
Florence Basaki, Uganda.
It It was a joyful moment. Baseki smiled and hugged her friend, calling her my daughter, my sweet Catherine.
My daughter, Master Frederick.
After receiving her certificate, Baseki wrote she is grateful, but wants immigration officials to know she wishes she'd had an interpreter. And Hardinger read aloud the message Baseki wants everyone to hear.
I say it because I am now a U.S. citizen.
Congratulations and welcome.
For NPR News, I'm Anna Huntsman in Cleveland.
People around the world are switching religions or leaving religion altogether. A new study from Pew Research finds that large portions of adults no longer practice the faith in which they were raised. Pew surveyed nearly 80,000 people in 36 countries. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose reports.
Switching is especially common in East Asia, Europe, and the Americas. Kirsten Lesage is the study's lead author.
Out of the 36 countries that we surveyed in, the three countries with the highest rates of religious switching are South Korea, Spain, and Canada.
In South Korea, Pew found that 50% of respondents had changed religions. In Spain, 40% said they'd left their childhood faith. In Canada, the number is 38%. By comparison, in the U.S., 28% switched. Lesage says two religions were most affected.
The religious groups that have had the largest losses from religious switching are Christianity and Buddhism.
Lesage says the change is particularly acute in parts of Europe.
For example, Italy has the highest ratio of people leaving to people joining Christianity.
For every one person who becomes Christian, about 28 Italians are leaving the religion. The biggest gains were among those who have no religious affiliation, which is a group that includes atheists, agnostics, and those who describe themselves as nothing in particular.
So it's not the case that people are necessarily switching from one religion to the next. For example, there's not a lot of switching from Christianity into Islam.
Rather, Lesage says, most switching is people leaving religion altogether. Meanwhile, specific religions in some countries appear to be stickier than others. Pew found very small percentages of the overall adult population have left or joined Islam in most of the countries surveyed, and nearly all people who were raised Hindu in India and Bangladesh still identify as Hindu today. Judaism's retention rate is also high. In Israel, 100% of people Pew surveyed who were raised Jewish still identify religiously as Jewish. In the U.S., 76% of those raised Jewish still identify that way today, with most American Jews who've left the faith now identifying as unaffiliated. Pew also found that 19% of U.S. adults raised as Christian now identify as religiously unaffiliated. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The countdown is on for federally funded museums and institutions that have Native American human remains. In January of 2024, the Department of the Interior updated a law known as NAGPRA in order to expedite the return of those remains to Native American tribes within 5 years after decades of delays and broken promises. The Ohio History Connection is now doing an inventory of its own collection. It's one of the nation's largest, and it's collaborating with tribes to repatriate remains in an effort to meet the deadline. Adriana Martinez-Smiley from member station WYSO reports.
At the Ohio History Center, Neil Thompson guides me through an exhibit of the state's UNESCO World Heritage Site, the Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks.
This exhibit chronicles the eight earthworks.
They're scaled images of ancient rock art, models of Ohio's environment centuries ago, and excavated items used in Native American rituals. But out of view are more than 6,500 Native American human remains from tribes that were forcibly removed from the state in the 19th century. The Ohio History Connection, the state's preservation hub, possesses the remains and runs the center in Columbus. It's actively consulting with the 45 tribes tied to the Ohio River Valley to repatriate their remains. But chief of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma, Glenna Wallace, says work's been slow-moving.
Without question, this is a very delicate, but it is a crucial conversation and one that is very important to all of us. There is an urgency about it. It has been on the back burner for far too long.
The urgency Wallace is referring to are updates to the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, also known as NAGPRA. This law requires federally funded museums to identify Native American remains and funerary objects in their possession and work with the tribes from which they were taken to repatriate them. It passed in 1990, but last January, the U.S. Department of the Interior revised its regulations to streamline the repatriation process. It gave institutions 5 years to identify what's in their inventories and consult with tribal nations. That's a cumbersome process, says Stacia Kusayeski, Chief Operations Officer of Ohio History.
Our NAGPRA staff is really cross-referencing the time of the ancestors, what time frame they're from, with the geography of where they came from, and then who would have been on that land.
Several tribal leaders say it's good to finally see progress on returning the remains, but they also find it difficult to navigate the new requirements. Tribal nations and museums foot most of the costs. Federal grants exist, but they're so competitive, some refer to NAGPRA as an unfunded mandate. Logan York, Historic Preservation Officer of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma, says four of the five staffers dealing with its NAGPRA consultations aren't paid to do the work.
We are now on this timeline to make sure that our ancestors are treated with respect, but we have no more funding to make sure it's done correctly.
The Trump administration has not indicated there would be any change to NAGPRA. In a statement to NPR, Department spokesman Jordan Pfeiffer only says that Interior Secretary Doug Burgum looks forward to working with tribes on this and other issues. There are other concerns besides a lack of funding and time. Historic Ohio tribes' remains are scattered about the country. For example, Chief of the Shawnee Tribe, Ben Barnes, says it has to work with 26 states for NAGPRA consultations and only has two staff members to do it.
There's no single NAGPRA consult that's typical. Some can take years, some can take months, some can take weeks. Some collections are overseas, some are split collections. Some of the ancestors were loaned out to another institution.
Eastern Shawnee Chief Glenna Wallace says each tribe has their own approach to repatriation, but they are all looking for the same outcome.
Our belief is that those remains are, that spirit is not at rest, that spirit is not at ease until it goes back to Mother Earth. And that has not happened, and that's what needs to happen.
Wallace says working to reinter these remains is a challenge, but it's a challenge each tribe is capable of meeting. For NPR News, this is Adriana Martinez-Smiley in Dayton, Ohio.
For the first time ever, a recreation of the annex where Anne Frank and her family hid from Nazis is available outside of Amsterdam. NPR's Sarah Ventry walked through the exhibit, which is currently on display at the Center for Jewish History in New York, and she spoke with visitors who found its themes had strong reverberations for them in today's political climate.
Walking into the exhibit, there's a striking mix of the familiar and the unsettling.
And now we're entering the space in which ultimately, 8 people wind up living in.
Michael Glickman is an advisor to the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam. Frank lived in a space just like this one, with her parents, Otto and Edith, her sister Margot, and 4 others. She was there for more than 2 years before they were discovered and killed.
They're forced in 1942 to move the family at the time that Margot is, she receives a summons to report to a German labor camp. And she's instructed to be there the next day.
So instead, the family went into hiding in something that looks a bit like a small, cramped apartment. The rooms are packed with the kind of details that are reminiscent of so many homes.
As many parents have done over time, you've got these markings in your home showing the growth chart of your children. And so Otto and Edith measured the girls in their time in hiding.
There are colorful rugs, neatly made beds, and even posters on the wall.
Anne is fascinated by the royal family, and you'll see images of Princess Margaret and Princess Elizabeth. She enjoys art, and you have work by Da Vinci and other artists. She's a teenage girl.
As a teenage girl, Anne Frank had to share her bedroom with a dentist, Fritz Pfeffer, who was 53 years old when he moved in. And in those tight quarters, their shared writing desk became a prized possession.
Fritz and Anne are constantly arguing over who gets to use the desk.
Fritz was studying Spanish because he hoped to move to South America after the war. And Anne was writing the diary that has now been translated into more than 75 languages and is still found in countless schools and libraries. Just as Anne Frank's diary continues to evoke strong feelings, the visitors to the exhibit say the questions raised by her life and death echo in our own time. Tracy Darrow came from the Bronx to see the exhibit.
Learning about Anne Frank in school, like, I didn't know that they tried to come to the U.S. So when you think about, like, oh, if you had to flee, it's like, where do you go? You know, what if, like, other countries are not taking you? Like, where do you go then?
Mark Kreidler says there are parallels between what he saw in the exhibit and what he sees happening around us today.
They said, oh, the Jews were deported, right, somewhere. And there is talk about deporting people from our country right now to prisons elsewhere.
33-year-old Sarah Crawford lives in New York.
I mean, I think the reason that Anne Frank appeals to so many people is because it just humanizes this experience that otherwise is so overwhelming to think about on this massive population scale. I think a lot of people can see themselves as a child in her.
The exhibit runs through the end of October. Sarah Ventry, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR News.
There's a shortage of primary care doctors in the U.S., and wait times for appointments are long. In response, some doctors are converting their practices to a membership model. They charge membership fees to patients in exchange for reliable care.
But that means fewer people have access. So each time any physician makes that switch, it exacerbates the shortage.
That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, advice for people who have some money in the stock market.
Basically, don't worry too much if you've seen your investment accounts decline lately.
At this time, you really just want to ride out what's going on in the markets because economies are cyclical.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Supreme Court upheld a Biden-era federal regulation today that bans the so-called sale of ghost guns. The build-it-yourself untraceable gun kits are mainly bought online. The vote was 7-2, as NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Writing for the court majority, Justice Neil Gorsuch said that under the broad language of the 1968 Gun Control Act, the ATF was well within its statutory power when it enacted a new rule requiring those who make and sell unassembled gun kits to mark their products with serial numbers, keep records of their sales, and conduct background checks on buyers. The 2022 ATF action was spurred by an explosion of unmarked guns found at crime scenes across the country. Despite the court's decision upholding the regulation, President Trump could try to rescind it. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The Danish foreign minister is welcoming the cancellation of a planned visit by White House National Security Advisor Mike Walls and the U.S. Energy Secretary to Greenland. As Terry Schultz reports, Vice President Vance will still be visiting, but with a pared-down agenda.
A press release from the Greenlandic government says previous plans for a U.S. delegation to visit various sites on the island have been canceled, and that Vice President Vance and his wife will go to the U.S. Patufik Space Base on Friday. Danish Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen says it's, quote, very positive that the Americans have canceled their visit among Greenlandic society, referring to Second Lady Usha Vance's earlier intention to travel to historic sites and watch a dog sled race. Rasmussen told the Danish public broadcaster DR that now the Vances will, quote, only visit their own base, Patufik, and we have nothing against that. Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen called the uninvited visit unacceptable pressure amid President Trump's threats to forcibly annex Greenland.
This is NPR. The American Heart Association says many teens enter adulthood with risk factors for heart disease already in place and supports expanding insurance access. NPR's Maria Godoy reports.
By age 18, many young adults already have high blood pressure, obesity, high cholesterol, or type 2 diabetes, according to the American Heart Association. It says a growing number of younger adults are experiencing adverse cardiovascular events. One challenge is that as adolescents transition into young adulthood, they may stop going for regularly scheduled doctor's visits, such as vaccinations or sports checkups. In some states, without expanded Medicaid access, young adults can lose Medicaid coverage when they turn 19. In its statement, the American Heart Association says it's important to support policies that expand insurance access across the lifespan. It also calls for leveraging telehealth to increase healthcare use among young adults. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Frito-Lay is recalling some Tostito chips in 13 states because they may contain milk that could cause allergic reactions. That recall includes 13-ounce bags of Tostitos Cantina traditional yellow corn chips. The company says people with allergies or severe sensitivity to milk could have an adverse reaction if they eat the chips. Frito-Lay says the affected bags were sold in southern and midwestern states. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Should public broadcasting still receive federal funding? That question was at the heart of a hearing on Capitol Hill today. The chief executives of both NPR and PBS testified in front of a House subcommittee named after Elon Musk's government budget slashing initiative, DOGE. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik was there and joins us now. And David, real quick before we begin, let's just acknowledge that under NPR's protocol for covering itself, no NPR corporate or news executive has had a hand in this coverage, right?
Not a single knuckle.
All right, let's get started. To get a sense of some of the criticism that was aired at this hearing, let's hear what Republican William Timmons of South Carolina said to NPR CEO Catherine Marr.
You agree that your job is to have journalistic integrity, right?
Absolutely, but there is a strong firewall between the newsroom and anything that I
do. Let's talk about the newsroom. You have 87 registered Democrats, not a single Republican in your editor board. So, I mean, how does that work to give us the perception that you're doing your job of actually delivering unbiased information?
Okay, David, let me just ask you, criticism like that has been aimed periodically at NPR. Why is this hearing happening right now in this moment?
So this question about bias in public media was reignited by an Uri Blinner essay a year ago. He's a longtime senior business editor at the network. He left the network after posting an essay in the Free Press. In fact, that number, 87 registered Democrats, comes from a quick survey he did of people he could find who worked at NPR, who lived in Washington, D.C., whose voter registrations he could find. Obviously, NPR has many hundreds of journalists, and so this is sort of a way he drilled down on that, that NPR doesn't necessarily affirm is reflective. But the reason it's being revived now is that you have the Republicans in power, both houses of Congress and at the White House. They are looking to cut all sorts of things throughout government, all kinds of public programs. It is reflective of kind of this anti-press posture, particularly of the Trump administration. And public media is often an easy target because taxpayer dollars are involved, of course. And that can be whether there's an episode of a children's show on public television that featured a performer reading to children in drag, or NPR's own chief executive, her social media posts well before she joined NPR, showing her often liberal and pro-democratic beliefs.
Okay, well, let's take up those allegations of supposed liberal pro-democratic bias in public broadcasting. Tell us how Catherine Marr, the CEO of NPR, and the head of PBS responded to that.
Well, both Catherine Marr and Paula Kerger, the longtime chief executive of PBS, spoke about the public service that their outlets and that the systems that they serve perform well beyond news. So, for example, both public radio stations around the country and public television stations play a vital role in the emergency and disaster response systems of the states and communities that they serve. Paula Kerger, PBS, talked about the children's programming, cultural shows they do at NPR. Catherine Marr talked about the news that they provided and also about the way in which, you know, regardless of what her beliefs may have been, and she said she kind of regretted posting a lot of those things, that NPR's newsroom is insulated from influence of corporate executives, including herself. That said, I think it's important to acknowledge Marr yielded ground on coverage of several issues, most prominently the way in which the network responded to the Hunter Biden laptop story.
If Republicans do follow through and call for, as they put it, the defunding and dismantling of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, how much money are we talking about here? And what impact would that have on NPR?
So listen, there's over $500 million spent on public media every year allocated directly by Congress. NPR receives, even indirectly, about 3% of its funds from federal sources. PBS far more, about 16%. But the chief of both networks, NPR and PBS, argue this will hit local stations much harder, and it'll particularly hit local stations areas that are very poorly served by corporate media. And they point to the rural America, and they say that's where you're going to see harm done, where stations in many cases are going to have to close if these federal dollars dry up.
That is NPR's David Folkenflik on Capitol Hill. Thank you so much, David.
You bet.
Vice President J.D. Vance says he'll join his wife, Second Lady Usha Vance, on her visit to Greenland this week. The announcement followed criticism of what was originally planned as a solo trip. It was billed as a private affair. The visit comes as President Trump once again suggests the U.S. should annex the self-governing Danish territory. That is an idea that Denmark and Greenland have repeatedly rejected. Adrian Murray reports from Copenhagen.
Usha Vance was to lead a U.S. delegation on what was billed as a private trip to attend one of Greenland's biggest cultural events, the National Sled Dog Race. But last evening, there was a surprise change.
Hey guys, it's J.D. Vance, the Vice President.
Vance revealed he'd join his wife for the trip this Friday, but their itinerary will only include a visit to Pituffik, an American-run military base in Greenland's far north.
Unfortunately, leaders in both America and in Denmark, I think, ignored Greenland for far too long. That's been bad for Greenland. It's also been bad for the security of the entire world. We think we can take things in a different direction, so I'm going to go check it out.
Whatever form it takes now, the visit continues to stir controversy, says Aya Chemnitz, a Greenlandic MP in the Danish parliament.
This is not an official visit, and nobody officially invited them from the democratic political system. This is at a very bad timing, and it is very disrespectful towards the majority in Greenland.
Greenland has recently demonstrated outside the U.S. consulate in the capital Nuuk. Trump's repeated calls for U.S. control over the Arctic territory are causing frustration. Speaking to the Danish public broadcaster DR shortly before Vance's announcement, Denmark's Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said the American visit this week was a serious matter.
It is an unacceptable pressure that is being placed on both Greenland and Denmark in this session. It is also a pressure that we will resist. I have said several times since January 7th that I and we take this situation very seriously. President Trump is serious. He wants Greenland.
U.S. Second Lady Usha Vance had been scheduled to visit Greenland's capital Nuuk and the Arctic town Ussishimut. But a silent protest with locals turning their backs on the American delegation had been planned, and politicians and some businesses turned down meetings. The American visit now takes place away from the public eye. Some view that as a climb down by the United States, but there's also caution about what comes next. Julie Rademacher is a Danish-Greenlandic analyst.
Greenland wasn't prepared. Denmark wasn't prepared. We are normally very close allies with the US. The last couple of weeks, and specifically also the last couple of days, they have been confusing. It's very difficult to find out what is the goal for the new U.S. administration.
Last weekend, Hercules cargo planes unloaded bulletproof vehicles for what was planned as a private visit. But they won't be needed for the changed itinerary, going only to an American military base 750 miles north of the Arctic Circle. For NPR, I'm Adrienne Murray in Copenhagen.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Farmers think of feral hogs as a menace. The USDA says they cause at least $2.5 billion of damage every year across 35 states. Kelly Knoyer from member station WHQR reports how feral hog trappers are trying to do their part.
Jamie Pearson is a farmer in Sampson County, North Carolina, and he's seen the damage feral hogs can do. 3 years ago, feral hogs struck some of his fields like a hurricane.
I mean, that sounds crazy, but you know, it don't take them long to go across 150 acres.
He says his hay fields had craters, and his corn fields looked like they had crop circles. He was desperate. And then he found a USDA eradication program. It employs people like trapper Randy Poley. He is, more or less, at war with feral hogs in rural North Carolina.
Hog trapping it takes a lot of patience because we don't want to educate. You don't want to catch half the group and educate the other half.
Educate them, as in unintentionally teach the remaining hogs how to avoid capture. Yes, hogs are that smart. Pulley uses corral traps on farmers' properties, big circular cages with guillotine doors. He uses cameras to monitor about a dozen traps across multiple counties, and he tries to catch the entire family group in one go.
Because once you drop that door and a pig outside sees that, they're very smart. He's going to learn that. It's ingrained in his mind. You'll never catch him in a trap again, not a corral trap.
When that door falls, the entire sounder, that's what a family group of pigs is called, starts sprinting around the corral. Biologists say trapping is the most effective way to take out feral hogs. You can kill the entire group in one go. Pulley says hunting them individually isn't as effective.
Going in a cornfield, standing corn when you can't see, you're going row to row. You're trying to get downwind of the pigs. You can hear them breaking. You're trying to get to them without them knowing you're there. You can only see down one row at a time.
But recreational hog hunting is big business in North Carolina. There are over a dozen companies offering hog hunts in the state, including Carolina Razorback Outfitters. Owner Jody Rhodes says it's become his full-time gig. He charges $350 per person per night for hog hunting. Rhodes says hunting helps cut down the population.
If they stop hunting, or i.e. overregulate it, they're just going to increase the population. So if we can't get rid of them, well, let's nurture them. Let's make some money off of them.
But Pulley doesn't think it really helps that much.
Usually recreational hunters are looking to, you know, take the trophy hog, the big hog, the male hog with the, you know, biggest cutters, or they're not there to euthanize the entire group.
A handful of states have banned hog hunting entirely, hoping to end the incentive to have hogs on rural land and eventually eradicate them through trapping. But that's a tough sell, says North Carolina wildlife biologist Fallon Owens. That's because hog hunting culture is well established here.
So it's challenging to institute feral swine hunting bans because of the cultural and socioeconomic benefits that some people have for having feral swine on the landscape.
It's spring now, and those swine are certainly on the landscape, eating corn seeds and keeping Pulley on his toes.
Now I'm out 4, sometimes 5 nights a week, weekends, so it's very, very busy.
He'll be waking up every time his phone goes off, telling him hogs have entered his traps. For NPR News, I'm Kelly Knoyer in Sampson County, North Carolina.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump administration is slashing jobs across the federal government. And now, scientists are warning that caught up in those cuts is a small, obscure laboratory whose measurements are essential for everything from advanced microchip manufacturing to the study of distant stars. Joining us now to discuss why researchers are so concerned about this closure is NPR science correspondent Jeff Brumfield. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so where is this laboratory?
It's in Gaithersburg, Maryland at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And I got to say right off the bat, if you're looking for waste and fraud, NIST is not personally where I'd start in the government. I've been there many times. Uh-huh. The labs are pretty simple, pretty spare. The parking lot is like full of Subarus and 2014 Toyota Priuses. But the scientists who work there provide the piping which supports our high-tech economy.
The piping? Wait, so what does this particular lab do?
This is known as the Atomic Spectroscopy Group. Okay. They had a couple of duties, but perhaps the most important one was to maintain a database of atomic spectra. So you're ready
still
for,
confused.
Ready for a little chemistry 101?
Oh, I don't know. Okay.
Okay, so atoms absorb and release very specific colors of light. And for more than a century, scientists and engineers have been using those colors as a sort of atomic fingerprint. Mm-hmm. I spoke to Elizabeth Goldschmidt, a physicist at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and she says these fingerprints of atoms get used everywhere.
So you look at a star, you look at the very specific colors that you're seeing from the star, it can tell you about the makeup of the star. You look at the blood in someone's finger and you look at the specific colors that you're seeing and how much absorption there is, and that can tell you about how much oxygen is in the blood.
And the list goes on and on. Atomic clocks, GPS, light bulbs, nuclear fusion. Everywhere in industry and in science, they use these fingerprints.
Cool.
But just like real fingerprints, you need a database. And that's what this laboratory does. It maintains the catalog of all these atomic fingerprints. The group has existed for more than 120 years,
wow.
And now it may close in a matter of weeks.
Dang. Okay, so do we know why the Trump administration wants to close this lab then?
NIST and the Department of Commerce did not respond to our request for comment by deadline, but an email from the lab's head to some of his colleagues was seen by NPR, and it says that the work was, quote, not considered to be statutorily essential for the NIST mission. Mm-hmm. Now, I should say the savings from doing this will be minuscule. The lab had just 7 federal employees, and they've actually even been paying for their own coffee since 1973. Being
what?
A bunch of metrologists, they've kept the receipts. They have a little book, and they've kept track of who's been paying for that long.
Oh, my God. Okay, so if there's not much money that's going to be saved, do we know what the costs of closing this lab will be?
The scientists I spoke to all agree they'd be enormous. Think about it. Without this database, scientists and engineers will have to hunt around for the best measurements of these atomic fingerprints that they can find. And guess what? If two companies find different sets of fingerprints to calibrate their devices, those devices might give different results. So like a pulse oximeter at one doctor's office, in theory, might give a different reading for blood oxygen level than one from another doctor's office.
That seems like a problem.
Yeah. I mean, the bottom line, says Goldschmidt, is that this is a case where 7 government employees setting standards is enabling a lot of productive scientific and economic activity.
Everyone wins when this happens at NIST because everyone can rely on what NIST does and they don't have to invest their time or money in doing it themselves.
And Elsa, even the founding fathers knew this. Article 1 of the Constitution empowers Congress to, quote, fix the standard of weights and measures.
I've always wondered what that was about.
Well, it's about this. It's about setting standards for things like atomic spectra.
That is NPR's Jeff Brumfield. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thanks, Elsa.
About 60% of Americans have some money in the stock market. If you are one of those people and you've recently logged into your investment account, you may be feeling a little bit alarmed. The markets have fallen lately. For instance, the S&P 500 dropped by 10% between mid-February and mid-March of this year. There are reasons investor fears about tariffs or a possible recession. At the same time, when it comes to the stock market, ups and downs are just part of the deal. NPR Life Kit host Marielle Sagata has advice on what to do in moments like this one.
Your instinct in these down moments might be to sell everything and never invest in the stock market again. But the advice here is don't do that and try not to panic. Bola Shokhambi is the founder CEO of Clever Girl Finance, a financial education platform for women.
The truth is that when the market is declining, unless you actually sell it, you haven't lost anything. You still have the asset. You still have the stock that you invested in. And at this time, you really just want to ride out what's going on in the markets because economies are cyclical.
Also, to put the current decline in perspective, the S&P 500 has seen 10 other drops of this magnitude or more since the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, according to the consulting firm Yardeni Research. But stocks always came back up again. Also, several of the major stock market indexes are still up compared to where they were a year ago. A general rule with the stock market, if you have diverse investments, and if you stay the course and don't rush to sell your stocks when the market drops, over the long term, you can expect to come out with more money than when you started.
So when you talk about investing in the stock market, historically, the average rate of return is about 8% after inflation or about 10% before inflation.
That's per year. Now let's talk about diverse investments for a second. You want to spread your money out. Buy different kinds of bonds, buy stocks in lots of different companies from different sectors. One way to do that is through index funds.
Which is basically a benchmark that tracks something like, for example, the S&P 500, which are the 500 largest companies in the U.S. that are traded on the stock market, right? So that kind of helps you create a sense of less emotional turmoil because your money is invested across technology, healthcare, consumer staples, you know, so many different categories.
If markets are down across the board, yeah, you will see the same in your index funds. But if it's just a couple sectors or companies taking a hit, you own shares in other companies and that'll limit your losses. Shokhambi says there are a lot of emotions that come up around investing. Excitement, yeah, but also fear and regret.
If you are investing for the long term, which you should be, then give yourself a break. If you don't need the money anytime soon, then it's okay not to log into your account this week or this month or this quarter so that you're not overwhelming yourself.
Also, she recommends keeping 3 to 6 months of basic living expenses in an FDIC or NCUA insured savings account. That way you have a financial cushion in the short term, regardless of what's happening in the stock market. For NPR News, I'm Mariel Segarra.
Life Kit has more personal finance tips, including how to refresh your budget and how to manage debt. You can find those at npr.org/lifekit.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from The Station and from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach. Starts Friday in theaters. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options, at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs, with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com.
It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. I'd like to sup with my baby tonight. Refill the cup with my baby tonight. I'd like to sup with my baby tonight. Refill the cup with my baby tonight. But I ain't up to my baby tonight, 'cause it's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. I'd like to coo with my baby tonight and pitch the woo with my baby tonight. I'd like to coo with my baby tonight and pitch the woo with my baby tonight. But brother, you fight my